Part 4. Here a heckler asks, with the arrogant air of one wanting to see a gentleman's driving license, how did the prof reconcile his refusal to grant the future the status of time with the fact that it, the future, could hardly be considered non-existent, since it possessed at least one future, I mean feature, involving such an important idea as that of absolute necessity? Throw him out. Who said I shall die? Refuting the determinist statement more elegantly, unconsciousness, far from awaiting us with flyback and noose, somewhere ahead, envelops both the past and the present from all conceivable sides, being a character not of time itself, but of organic decline natural to all things, whether conscious of time or not. That I know others die is irrelevant to the case. I also know that you, and probably I, were born. But that does not prove we went through the chronal phase called the past. My present, my brief span of consciousness tells me I did, not this silent thunder of the infinite unconscious proper to my birth 52 years and 195 days ago. My first recollection goes back to mid-July 1870, i.e., my 7th month of life. With most people, of course, retentive consciousness starts somewhat later, at 3 or 4 years of age. When, one morning, in our Riviera villa, a chunk of green plaster ornament dislodged from the ceiling by an earthquake crashed into my cradle. The 195 days preceding that event being indistinguishable from infinite unconsciousness are not to be included in perceptual time, so that, insofar as my mind and my pride of mind are concerned, I am today, mid-July 1922, quite exactly 52. Etreve de mon style plafond peint. In the same sense of individual perceptual time, I can put my past in reverse gear, enjoy this moment of recollection as much as I did the horn of abundance whose stucco pineapple just missed my head, and postulate that next moment a cosmic or corporeal cataclysm might not kill me, but plunge me into a permanent state of stupor, of a type sensationally new to science, thus depriving natural dissolution of any logical or chronal sense. Furthermore, this reasoning takes care of the much less interesting, albeit important, universal time. We had a thumping time chopping heads, also known as objective time, really woven most coarsely of private times, the history, in a word, of humanity and humor, and that kind of thing. Nothing prevents mankind as much from having no future at all, if, for example, our genus evolves by imperceptible, this is the ramp of my argument, degrees a novo sapiens species or another subgenus altogether, which will enjoy other varieties of being and dreaming beyond man's notion of time. Man, in that sense, will never die, because there may never be a taxonomical point in his evolutionary progress that could be determined as the last stage of man in the cline turning him into neo-homo or some horrible throbbing slime. I think our friend will not bother us any further. My purpose in writing my Texture of Time, a difficult, delectable, and blessed work, a work which I am about to place on the dawning desk of the still absent reader, is to purify my own notion of time. I wish to examine the essence of time, not its lapse, for I do not believe that its essence can be reduced to its lapse. I wish to caress time. One can be a lover of space and its possibilities. Take, for example, speed, the smoothness and sword swish of speed, the aquiline glory of ruling velocity, the joy cry of the curve, and one can be an amateur of time, an epicure of duration. I delight sensually in time, in its stuff and spread, in the fall of its folds, in the very impalpability of its grayish gauze, in the coolness of its continuum. I wish to do something about it, to indulge in a simulacrum of possession. I am aware that all who have tried to reach the charmed castle have got lost in obscurity or have bogged down in space. I am also aware that time is a fluid medium for the culture of metaphors. Why is it so difficult, so degradingly difficult, to bring the notion of time into mental focus and keep it there for inspection? What an effort, what fumbling, what irritating fatigue. It is like rummaging with one hand in the glove compartment for the roadmap, fishing out Montenegro, the Dolomites, paper money, a telegram, everything except the stretch of chaotic country between Ardèze and something soprano, in the dark, in the rain, while trying to take advantage of a red light in the cold black, with the wipers functioning metronomically, chronometrically, the blind finger of space poking and tearing the texture of time. And Aurelius Augustinus, too, he too, in his tussles with the same theme, 1500 years ago, experienced this oddly physical torment of the shallowing mind, the chicotiki, tickles of approximation, the evasions of cerebral exhaustion. But he, at least, could replenish his brain with God-dispensed energy. Have a footnote here about how delightful it is to watch him pressing on and interspersing his cogitations between sands and stars with vigorous little fits of prayer. Lost again. Where was I? Where am I? Mud road. Stopped car. Time is rhythm. The insect rhythm of a warm, humid night, brain ripple, breathing, the drum in my temple. These are our faithful timekeepers, and reason corrects the feverish beat. A patient of mine could make out the rhythm of flashes succeeding one another every 3 milliseconds. 0.003. On. What nudged, what comforted me a few minutes ago at the stop of a thought? Yes. Maybe the only thing that hints at a sense of time is rhythm. Not the recurrent beats of the rhythm, but the gap between two such beats, the gray gap between black beats, the tender interval. The regular throb itself merely brings back the miserable idea of measurement, but in between, something like true time lurks. How can I extract it from its soft hollow? The rhythm should be neither too slow nor too fast. 1 beat per minute is already far beyond my sense of succession, and 5 oscillations per second make a hopeless blur. The ample rhythm causes time to dissolve. The rapid one crowds it out. Give me, say, 3 seconds. Then I can do both. Perceive the rhythm and probe the interval. A hollow, did I say? A dim pit? But that is only space, the comedy villain, returning by the back door with the pendulum he peddles, while I grope for the meaning of time. What I endeavor to grasp is precisely the time that space helps me to measure. And no wonder I fail to grasp time, since knowledge gaining itself takes time. If my eye tells me something about space, my ear tells me something about time. But while space can be contemplated naively, perhaps, yet directly, I can listen to time only between stresses, for a brief concave moment, warily and worriedly, with the growing realization that I am listening not to time itself, but to the blood current coursing through my brain, and thence through the veins of the neck heartward, back to the seat of private throes, which have no relation to time. The direction of time, the artist of time, one-way time. Here is something that looks useful to me one moment but dwindles the next to the level of an illusion obscurely related to the mysteries of growth and gravitation. The irreversibility of time, which is not heading anywhere in the first place, is a very parochial affair. Had our organs and orgatrons not been asymmetrical, our view of time might have been amphitheatric and altogether grand, like ragged night and jagged mountains around a small, twinkling, satisfied hamlet. We are told that if a creature loses its teeth and becomes a bird, the best the latter can do when needing teeth again is to evolve a serrated beak, never the real dentition it once possessed. The scene is Eocene, and the actors are fossils. It is an amusing instance of the way nature cheats, but it reveals as little relation to essential time, straight or round, as the fact of my writing from left to right does to the course of my thought. And speaking of evolution, Can we imagine the origin and stepping stones and rejected mutations of time? Has there ever been a primitive form of time in which, say, the past was not yet clearly differentiated from the present, so that past shadows and shapes showed through the still, soft, long, larval now? Or did that evolution only refer to timekeeping, from sand glass to atomic clock, and from that to portable pulsar? And what time did it take for old time to become Newton's? Ponder the egg, as the French cock said to his hens. Pure time, perceptual time, tangible time, time free of content, context, and running commentary. This is my time and theme. All the rest is numerical symbol or some aspect of space. The texture of space is not that of time, and the piebald four-dimensional sport bred by relativists is a quadruped with one leg replaced by the ghost of a leg. My time is also motionless time. We shall presently dispose of flowing time, water clock time, water closet time. The time I am concerned with is only the time stopped by me and closely attended to by my tense-willed mind. Thus it would be idle and evil to drag in passing time. Of course I shave longer when my thought tries on words. Of course I am not aware of the lag until I look at my watch. Of course, at 50 years of age, 1 year seems to pass faster, because it is a smaller fraction of my increased stock of existence, and also because I am less often bored than I was in childhood, between dull game and duller book. But that quickening depends precisely upon one's not being attentive to time. It is a queer enterprise, this attempt to determine the nature of something consisting of phantomic phases, yet I trust that my reader, who by now is frowning over these lines, but ignoring at least his breakfast, will agree with me that there is nothing more splendid than lone thought. And lone thought must plod on, or, to use a less ancient analogy, drive on, say, in a sensitive, admirably balanced Greek car that shows its sweet temper and road-holding assurance at every turn of the Alpine highway. Two fallacies should be dealt with before we go any further. The first is the confusion of temporal elements with spatial ones. Space, the imposter, has been already denounced in these notes, which are now being set down during half a day's break in a crucial journey. His trial will take place at a later stage of our investigation. The second dismissal is that of an immemorial habit of speech. We regard time as a kind of stream, having little to do with an actual mountain torrent showing white against a black cliff or a dull-colored great river in a windy valley, but running invariably through our chronographical landscapes. We are so used to that mythical spectacle, so keen upon liquefying every lap of life, that we end up by being unable to speak of time without speaking of physical motion. Actually, of course, the sense of its motion is derived from many natural or at least familiar sources, the body's innate awareness of its own bloodstream, the ancient vertigo caused by rising stars, and, of course, our methods of measurement, such as the creeping shadow line of a gnomon, the trickle of an hourglass, the trot of a second hand. And here, we are back in space. Note the frames, the receptacles, the idea that time flows as naturally as an apple thuds down on a garden table implies that it flows in and through something else. And if we take that something to be space, then we have only a metaphor flowing along a yardstick. But beware, anime meus, of the Marcel wave of fashionable art. Avoid the Proustian bed and the assassin pun, itself a suicide, as those who know their Verlaine. We are now ready to tackle space. We reject without qualms the artificial concept of space-tainted, space-parasited time, the space-time of relativist literature. Anyone, if he likes, may maintain that space is the outside of time or the body of time, or that space is suffused with time and vice versa, or that, in some peculiar way, space is merely the waste product of time, even its corpse, or that in the long, infinitely long run, time is space. That sort of gossip may be pleasing, especially when we are young, but no one shall make me believe that the movement of matter, say a pointer across a carved-out area of space, say a dial, is by nature identical with the passing of time. Movement of matter merely spans an extension of some other palpable matter against which it is measured, but tells us nothing about the actual structure of impalpable time. Similarly, a graduated tape, even of infinite length, is not space itself, nor can the most exact odometer represent the road which I see as a black mirror of rain under turning wheels, hear as a sticky rustle, smell as a damp July night in the Alps, and feel as a smooth basis. We, poor Spartans, are better adapted in our three-dimensional lacrimival to extension rather than to duration. Our body is capable of greater stretching than volitional recall can boast of. I cannot memorize, though I sought only yesterday to resolve it into mnemonic elements, the number of my new car. But I feel the asphalt under my front tires as if they were parts of my body. Yet space itself, like time, is nothing I can comprehend, a place where motion occurs, a plasm in which matter, concentrations of space plasm, is organized and enclosed. We can measure the globules of matter and the distances between them, but space plasm itself is incomputable. We measure time, a second hand trots or a minute hand jerks, from one painted mark to another, in terms of space, without knowing the nature of either. But the spanning of space does not always require time, or at least does not require more time than the now point of the specious present contains in its hollow. The perceptual perception of a unit of space is practically instantaneous when, for example, an expert driver's eye takes in a highway symbol, the black mouth and neat archivolt within a red triangle, a blend of color and shape recognized in no time, when properly seen, as meaning a road tunnel, or something of less immediate importance, such as the delightful Venus sign, which might be misunderstood as permitting horlets to thumb rides, but actually tells the worshipper or sightseer that a church is reflected in the local river. I suggest adding a pilcrow for persons who read while driving. Space is related to our senses of sight, touch, and muscular effort. Time is vaguely connected with hearing. Still, a deaf man would perceive the passage of time incomparably better than a blind, limbless man would the idea of passage. Space is a swarming in the eyes, and time a singing in the ears, says John Shade, a modern poet, as quoted by an invented philosopher, Martin Gardner, in The Ambidextrous Universe, page 165. Space flutters to the ground, but time remains between thinker and thumb, when Monsieur Bergson uses his scissors. Space introduces its eggs into the nests of time, a before here, an after there, and a speckled church of Minkowski's world points. A stretch of space is organically easier to measure mentally than a stretch of time. The notion of space must have been formed before that of time. Guillot in Whitrow. The indistinguishable inane lock of infinite space is mentally distinguishable, and indeed could not be imagined otherwise, from the ovoid void of time. Space thrives on surds. Time is irreducible to blackboard roots and birdies. The same section of space may seem more extensive to a fly than to St. Alexander, but a moment to him is not hours to a fly. Because if that were true, flies would know better than wait to get swapped. I cannot imagine space without time, but I can very well imagine time without space. Space-time, that hideous hybrid whose very hyphen looks phony. One can be a hater of space and a lover of time. There are people who can fold a map. Not this writer. At this point, I suspect I should say something about my attitude to relativity. It is not sympathetic. What many cosmogonists tend to accept as an objective truth is really the flaw inherent in mathematics, which parades as truth. The body of the astonished person moving in space is shortened in the direction of motion and shrinks catastrophically as the velocity nears the speed beyond which, by the fiat of a fishy formula, no speed can be. That is his bad luck, not mine. But I sweep away the business of his clocks slowing down. Time, which requires the utmost purity of consciousness to be properly apprehended, is the most rational element of life, and my reason feels insulted by those flights of technology fiction. One especially grotesque inference drawn, I think, by Engelwein from relativity theory, and destroying it if drawn correctly, is that the galactonaut and his domestic animals, after touring the speed spas of space, would return younger than if they had stayed at home all the time. Imagine them filing out of their air arc, rather like those lions juvenilified by romp suits, exuding from one of those huge chartered buses that stop, horribly blinking, in front of a man's impatient sedan, just where the highway wizens to squeeze through the narrows of a mountain village. Perceived events can be regarded as simultaneous when they belong to the same span of attention. In the same way, insidious simile, unremovable obstacle, as one can visually possess a unit of space, say a vermilion ring with a frontal view of a toy car within its white kernel, forbidding the lane into which, however, I turned with a furious coup de volant. I know relativists, hampered by their light signals and traveling clocks, try to demolish the idea of simultaneity on a cosmic scale, but let us imagine a gigantic hand with its thumb on one star and its minimus on another. Will it not be touching both at the same time? Or are tactile coincidences even more misleading than visual ones? I think I had better back out of this passage. Such a drought affected Hippo in the most productive months of Augustine's bishopric that clepsydras had to be replaced by sand glasses. He defined the past as what is no longer and the future as what is not yet. Actually, the future is a phantasm belonging to another category of thought, essentially different from that of the past, which at least was here a moment ago. Where did I put it? Pocket? But the search itself is already past. The past is changeless, intangible, and never to be revisited. Terms that do not fit this or that section of space, which I see, for instance, as a white villa and its whiter, newer garage, with seven cypresses of unequal length, tall Sunday and short Monday, watching over the private road that loops past scrub oak and briar, down to the public one, connecting Sorcière with the highway to Montroux, still 100 miles apart. I shall now proceed to consider the past as an accumulation of sensa, not as the dissolution of time implied by immemorial metaphors picturing transition. The passage of time is merely a figment of the mind, with no objective counterpart, but with easy spatial analogies. It is seen only in rear view, shapes and shades, arolas and larches silently tumbling away, the perpetual disaster of receding time. Éboulement, landslides, mountain roads where rocks are always falling and men always working. We build models of the past and then use them spatiologically to reify and measure time. Let us take a familiar example. Zambra, a quaint old town on the Minder River near Sorcière in the Valais, was being lost by degrees among new buildings. By the beginning of this century, it had acquired a definitely modern look, and the preservation people decided to act. Today, after years of subtle reconstruction, a replica of the old Zambra, with its castle, its church, and its mill extrapolated onto the other side of the Minder, stands opposite the modernized town, and separated from it by the length of a bridge. Now, if we replace the spatial view, as seen from a helicopter, by the chronal one, as seen by a retrospector, and the material model of old Zambra by the mental model of it in the past, say around 1822, The modern town and the model of the old turn out to be something else than two points in the same place at different times. In spatial perspective, they are at the same time in different places. The space in which the modern town coagulates is immediately real, while that of its retrospective image, as seen apart from material restoration, shimmers in an imaginary space, and we cannot use any bridge to walk from the one to the other. In other words, as one puts it when both writer and reader flounder at last in hopeless confusion of thought, by making a model of the old town in one's mind, and on the minder, all we do is to spatialize it, or actually drag it out of its own element onto the shore of space. Thus the term one century does not correspond in any sense to the 100 feet of steel bridge between modern and model towns, and that is what we wished to prove, and have now proven. The past, then, is a constant accumulation of images. It can be easily contemplated and listened to, tested and tasted at random, so that it ceases to mean the orderly alternation of linked events that it does in the large theoretical sense. It is now a generous chaos out of which the genius of total recall, summoned on this summer morning in 1922, can pick anything he pleases, diamonds scattered all over the parquet in 1888, a russet black-hatted beauty at a Parisian bar in 1901, a humid red rose among artificial ones in 1883, the pensive half-smile of a young English governess in 1880, neatly reclosing her charge's prepuce after the bedtime treat, a little girl in 1884 licking the breakfast honey off the badly bitten nails of her spread fingers, the same at 33, confessing, rather late in the day, that she did not like flowers in vases, the awful pain striking him in the side while two children with a basket of mushrooms looked on in the merrily burning pine forest, and the startled quonk of a Belgian car, which he had overtaken and passed yesterday on a blind bend of the Alpine Highway. Such images tell us nothing about the texture of time into which they are woven, except, perhaps, in one matter which happens to be hard to settle. Does the coloration of a recollected object, or anything else about its visual effect, differ from date to date? Could I tell by its tint if it comes earlier or later, lower or higher in the stratigraphy of my past? Is there any mental uranium whose dream delta decay might be used to measure the age of a recollection? The main difficulty, I hasten to explain, consists in the experimenter not being able to use the same object at different times. Say, the Dutch stove with its little blue sailing boats in the nursery of Ardis Manor in 1884 and 1888, because of the two or more impressions borrowing from one another and forming a compound image in the mind. But if different objects are to be chosen, say the faces of two memorable coachmen, Ben Wright, 1884, and Trofim Fartikoff, 1888, it is impossible, insofar as my own research goes, to avoid the intrusion not only of different characteristics, but of different emotional circumstances that do not allow the two objects to be considered essentially equal before, so to speak, their being exposed to the action of time. I am not sure that such objects cannot be discovered. In my professional work, in the laboratories of psychology, I have devised myself many a subtle test, one of which, the method of determining female virginity without physical examination, today bears my name. Therefore, we can assume that the experiment can be performed, and how tantalizing, then, the discovery of certain exact levels of decreasing saturation or deepening brilliance, so exact that the something which I vaguely perceive in the image of a remembered but unidentifiable person, and which assigns it, somehow, to my early boyhood rather than to my adolescence, can be labeled, if not with a name, at least with a definite date, e.g. January 1st, 1908. Eureka! The EG worked. He was my father's former house tutor who brought me Alice in the Camera Obscura for my 8th birthday. Our perception of the past is not marked by the link of succession to as strong a degree as is the perception of the present and of the instance immediately preceding its point of reality. I usually shave every morning and am accustomed to change the blade in my safety razor after every second shave. Now and then I happen to skip a day, have to scrape off the next a tremendous growth of loud bristle, whose obstinate presence my fingers check again and again between strokes, and in such cases I use a blade only once. Now, when I visualize a recent series of shaves, I ignore the element of succession. All I want to know is whether the blade left in my silver plow has done its work once or twice. If it was once, the order of the two bristle-growing days in my mind has no importance. In fact, I tend to hear and feel the second, grittier morning first, and then to throw in the shaveless day, in consequence of which my beard grows in reverse, so to speak. If now, with some poor scraps of teased-out knowledge relating to the colored contents of the past, we shift our view and regard it simply as a coherent reconstruction of elapsed events, some of which are retained by the ordinary mind less clearly, if at all, than the others, we can indulge in an easier game with the light and shade of its avenues. Memory images include after images of sound, regurgitated, as it were, by the ear, which recorded them a moment ago while the mind was engaged in avoiding hitting school children, so that actually we can replay the message of the church clock after we have left Tertsen and its hushed but still echoing steeple behind. Reviewing those last steps of the immediate past involves less physical time than was needed for the clock's mechanism to exhaust its strokes, and it is this mysterious less which is a spatial characteristic of the still fresh past into which the present slipped during that instant inspection of shallow sounds. The less indicates that the past is in no need of clocks, and the succession of its events is not clock time, but something more in keeping with the authentic rhythm of time. We have suggested earlier that the dim intervals between the dark beats have the feel of the texture of time. The same, more vaguely, applies to the impressions received from perceiving the gaps of unremembered or neutral time between vivid events. I happen to remember in terms of color, grayish blue, purple, reddish gray, my three farewell lectures, public lectures on Mr. Bergson's time at a great university a few months ago. I recall less clearly, and indeed am able to suppress in my mind completely, the six-day intervals between blue and purple, and between purple and gray. But I visualize with perfect clarity the circumstances attending the actual lectures. I was a little late for the first, dealing with the past, and observed with a not unpleasant thrill, as if arriving at my own funeral, the brilliantly lighted windows of Counterstone Hall, and the small figure of a Japanese student who, being also late, overtook me at a wild scurry and disappeared in the doorway long before I reached its semicircular steps. At the second lecture, the one on the present, during the 5 seconds of silence and inward attention, which I requested from the audience in order to provide an illustration for the point, I, or rather the speaking jewel in my waistcoat pocket, was about to make regarding the true perception of time. The behemoth snores of a white-bearded sleeper filled the house, which, of course, collapsed. At the third and last lecture on the future, sham time, after working perfectly for a few minutes, my secretly recorded voice underwent an obscure mechanical disaster, and I preferred simulating a heart attack and being carried out into the night forever, insofar as lecturing was concerned, to trying to decipher and sort out the batch of crumpled notes in pale pencil which poor speakers are obsessed with in familiar dreams, attributed by Dr. Froide of Signy Mon Dieu to the dreamer's having read in infancy his adulterous parents' love letters. I give these ludicrous but salient details to show that the events to be selected for the test should be not only gaudy and graduated, 3 lectures in 3 weeks, but related to each other by their main feature, a lecturer's misadventures. The two intervals of 5 days each are seen by me as twin dimples, each brimming with a kind of smooth grayish mist and a faint suggestion of shed confetti, which maybe might leap into color if I allowed some casual memory to form in between the diagnostic limits. Because of its situation among dead things, that dim continuum cannot be essentially groped for, tasted, hearkened to as veins hollow between rhythmic beats. But it shares with it one remarkable indicium, the immobility of perceptual time. Synesthesia, to which I am inordinately prone, proves to be of great help in this type of task, a task now approaching its crucial stage, the flowering of the present. Now blows the wind of the present at the top of the past, at the top of the passes I have been proud to reach in my life, the Umbrella, the Fluella, the Furca, of my clearest consciousness. The moment changes at the point of perception only because I myself am in a constant state of trivial metamorphosis. To give myself, time to time, time, I must move my mind in the direction opposite to that in which I am moving, as one does when one is driving past a long row of poplars and wishes to isolate and stop one of them, thus making the green blur reveal and offer, yes, offer, its every leaf. Cretan behind me. This act of attention is what I called last year, the deliberate present, to distinguish it from its more general form, termed by Clay in 1882, the specious present. The conscious construction of one and the familiar current of the other give us 3 or 4 seconds of what can be felt as nowness. This nowness is the only reality we know. It follows the colored nothingness of the no longer and precedes the absolute nothingness of the future. Thus, in a quite literal sense, we may say that conscious human life lasts always only one moment. For at any moment of deliberate attention to our own flow of consciousness, we cannot know if that moment will be followed by another. As I shall later explain, I do not believe that anticipation, looking forward to a promotion or fearing a social blunder, as one unfortunate thinker puts it, plays any significant part in the formation of the specious present. Nor do I believe that the future is transformed into a third panel of time, even if we do anticipate something or other, a turn of the familiar road or the picturesque rise of 2 steep hills, one with a castle, the other with a church. For the more lucid the forevision, the less prophetic it is apt to be. Had that rascal behind me decided to risk it just now, he would have collided head-on with the truck that came from beyond the bend. And I and the view might have been eclipsed in the multiple smash. Our modest present is, then, the time span that one is directly and actually aware of, with the lingering freshness of the past still perceived as part of the nowness. In regard to everyday life and the habitual comfort of the body, reasonably healthy, reasonably strong, breathing the green breeze, relishing the aftertaste of the most exquisite food in the world, a boiled egg, it does not matter that we can never enjoy the true present, which is an instant of zero duration, represented by a rich smudge, as the dimensionless point of geometry is by a sizable dot in printer's ink on palpable paper. The normal motorist, according to psychologists and policemen, can perceive, visually, a unit of time as short in extension as 1/10 of a second. I had a patient, a former gambler, who could identify a playing card in a 5 times faster flash. It would be interesting to measure the instant we need to become aware of disappointed or fulfilled expectation. Smells can be very sudden. And in most people, the ear and sense of touch work quicker than the eye. Those 2 hitchhikers really smelled, the male one revoltingly. Since the present is but an imaginary point without an awareness of the immediate past, it is necessary to define that awareness. Not for the first time will space intrude if I say that what we are aware of as present is the constant building up of the past, its smoothly and relentlessly rising level. How meager. How magic. Here they are, the 2 rocky, ruin-crowned hills that I have retained for 17 years in my mind with decalcomaniac romantic vividness, though not quite exactly, I confess, memory likes the utsebyatina, what one contributes oneself. But the slight discrepancy is now corrected, and the act of artistic correction enhances the pang of the present. The sharpest feeling of nowness, in visual terms, is the deliberate possession of a segment of space collected by the eye. This is time's only contact with space, but it has far-reaching reverberation. To be eternal, the present must depend on the conscious spanning of an infinite expansure. Then and only then is the present equitable with timeless space. I have been wounded in my duel with the impostor. And now I drive into Montreux under garlands of heart-rending welcome. Today is Monday, July 14th, 1922, 5:13 p.m. by my wristwatch, 11:52 by my car's built-in clock, 4:10 by all the timepieces in town. The author is in a confused state of exhilaration, exhaustion, expectancy, and panic. He has been climbing with two Austrian guides and a temporarily adopted daughter in the incomparable Balkan Mountains. He spent most of May in Dalmatia and June in the Dolomites, and got letters in both places from Ada telling him of her husband's death, April 23rd, in Arizona. He started working his way west in a dark blue Argus, dearer to him than sapphires and Morphos, because she happened to have ordered an exactly similar one to be ready for her in Geneva. He collected three additional villas, two on the Adriatic and one at Ardèze in the northern Grisons. Late on Sunday, July 13th, in nearby Alvina, the concierge of the Alrun Palace handed him a cable that had waited for him since Friday. Arriving Montreux, Trois Signes, Monday, dinner time, I want you to wire me frankly if the date and the whole tra-la-la are inconvenient. He transmitted by the new Instantagram, flashed to the Geneva airport, a message ending in the last word of her 1905 cable, and despite the threats of a torrential night, set out by car for the Vaux. Traveling too fast and too wildly, he somehow missed the Oberhalbstein road at the Silplana Fork, 150 kilometers south of Alvina, wriggled back north via Chiavenna and Splügen to reach in apocalyptic circumstances Highway 19, an unnecessary trip of 100 kilometers, veered by mistake east to Chur, performed an unprintable U-turn, and covered in a couple of hours the 175 kilometer stretch westward to Brieg. The pale flush of dawn in his rear-vision mirror had long since turned to passionately bright daylight when he looped south by the new Finwald Road to Sorcière, where 17 years ago he had bought a house, now Villa Yolana. The three or four servants he had left there to look after it had taken advantage of his lengthy absence to fade away. So, with the enthusiastic help of two hitchhikers stranded in the vicinity, a disgusting youth from Hilden and his long-haired, slatternly, languorous Hilda, he had to break into his own house. His accomplices were mistaken if they expected to find loot and liquor there. After throwing them out, he vainly courted sleep on a sheetless bed and finally betook himself to the bird-mad garden where his two friends were copulating in the empty swimming pool and had to be shooed off again. It was now around noon. He worked for a couple of hours on his Texture of Time, begun in the Dolomites at the Lammermoor, not the best of his recent hotels. The utilitarian impulse behind the task was to keep him from brooding on the ordeal of happiness awaiting him 150 kilometers west. It did not prevent a healthy longing for a hot breakfast from making him interrupt his scribbling to seek out a roadside inn on his way to Montreux. The Three Swans, where he had reserved rooms 508, 509, 510, had undergone certain changes since 1905. A portly, plum-nosed Lucien did not recognize him at once, and then remarked that Monsieur was certainly not de-perishing, although actually Vaughn had almost reverted to his weight of 17 years earlier, having shed several kilos in the Balkans rock-climbing with crazy little Acrasia, now dumped in a fashionable boarding school near Florence. No, Madame Vinlander had not called. Yes, the hall had been renovated. Swiss-German Louis Vicht now managed the hotel, instead of his late father-in-law, Luigi Fantini. In the lounge, as seen through its entrance, the huge, memorable oil, three ample-haunched Lidas swapping lacustrine impressions, had been replaced by a neo-primitive masterpiece showing three yellow eggs and a pair of plumber's gloves on what looked like wet bathroom tiling. As Vaughn stepped into the elevator, followed by a black-coated receptionist, it acknowledged his footfall with a hollow clank, and then, upon moving, feverishly began transmitting a fragmentary report on some competition, possibly a tricycle race. Vaughn could not help feeling sorry that this blind, functional box, even smaller than the slop-pail lift he had formerly used at the back, now substituted for the luxurious affair of yore, an attentive hall of mirrors whose famous operator, white whiskers, eight languages, had become a button. In the hallway of 509, Vaughn recognized the Brusselot à la Sonde picture next to the pregnant-looking white closet, under whose round sliding doors the corner of the carpet, now gone, would invariably catch. In the salon itself, only a ladies' bureau and the balcony view were familiar. Everything else, the semi-transparent shredded tweed ornaments, the glass flower heads, the silk-covered armchairs, had been superseded by hoch-modern fixtures. He showered and changed and finished the flask of brandy in his dressing case and called the Geneva airport and was told that the last plane from America had just arrived. He went for a stroll and saw that the famous Murier that spread its great limbs over a humble lavatory on a raised terrace at the top of a cobbled lane was now in sumptuous purple-blue bloom. He had a beer at the cafe opposite the railway station and then automatically entered the flower shop next door.
This is the end of disc number 16. Please insert disc number 17.
He went for a stroll and saw that the famous Murier that spread its great limbs over a humble lavatory on a raised terrace at the top of a cobbled lane was now in sumptuous purple-blue bloom. He had a beer at the cafe opposite the railway station and then automatically entered the flower shop next door. He must be gaga to have forgotten what she said the last time about her strange anthophobia, somehow stemming from that débauche à trois 30 years ago. Roses she never liked anyway. He stared and was easily outstared by small carols from Belgium, long-stemmed pink sensations, vermilion superstars. There were also zinnias and chrysanthemums and potted aphalandras and two graceful fringe tails in an inset aquarium. Not wishing to disappoint the courteous old florist, he bought 17 odorless Bacara roses, asked for the directory, opened it at AD to AU, Montroux, lit upon Adore Yolande, Mademoiselle Secrète, Rue des Délices 6, and with American presence of mind had his bouquet sent there. People were already hurrying home from work. Mademoiselle Adder, in a sweat-stained frock, was climbing the stairs. The streets had been considerably quieter in the Sourdine past. The old Morris pillar, upon which the present Queen of Portugal figured once as an actress, no longer stood at the corner of Chemin de Mistrou, old corruption of the town's name. Must trucks roar through must rucks? The chambermaid had drawn the curtains. He wrenched them all open, as if resolved to prolong to its utmost limit the torture of that day. The ironwork balcony jutted out far enough to catch the slanting rays. He recalled his last glimpse of the lake on that dismal day in October 1905, after parting with Ada. Fuligula ducks were falling and rising upon the rain-pocked swell in concentrated enjoyment of doubled water. Along the lake walk, scrolls of froth curled over the ridges of advancing gray waves, and every now and then a welter heaved sufficiently high to splash over the parapet. But now, on this radiant summer evening, no waves foamed, no birds swam. Only a few seagulls could be seen, fluttering white over their black reflections. The wide, lovely lake lay in dreamy serenity, fretted with green undulations, roughed with blue, patched with glades of lucid smoothness between the acres. And in the lower right corner of the picture, as if the artist had wished to include a very special example of light, the dazzling wake of the westering sun pulsated through a lakeside Lombardy poplar that seemed both liquefied and on fire. A distant idiot, leaning backward on water skis behind a speedboat, started to rip the canvas. Fortunately, he collapsed before doing much harm, and at the same instant, the drawing room telephone rang. Now, it so happened that she had never, at least in adult life, spoken to him by phone. Hence, the phone had preserved the very essence, the bright vibration of her vocal cords, the little leap in her larynx, the laugh clinging to the contour of the phrase, as if afraid in girlish glee to slip off the quick words it rode. It was the timbre of their past, as if the past had put through that call, a miraculous connection. Artis 1886. Comment? Non, pas 88, 86. Goldenly, youthfully, it bubbled, with all the melodious characteristics he knew, or better say, recollected at once in the sequence they came. That entrain, that whelming of quasi-erotic pleasure, that assurance and animation, and, what was especially delightful, the fact that she was utterly and innocently unaware of the modulations entrancing him. There had been trouble with her luggage. There still was. Her two maids, who were supposed to have flown over the day before on a Laputa freight airplane with her trunks, had got stranded somewhere. All she had was a little valise. The concierge was in the act of making some calls for her. Would Vaughn come down? She was nevroyatno golodnaya, incredibly hungry. That telephone voice, by resurrecting the past and linking it up with the present, with the darkening slate-blue mountains beyond the lake, with the spangles of the sun wake dancing through the poplar, formed the centerpiece in his deepest perception of tangible time, the glittering now that was the only reality of time's texture. After the glory of the summit, there came the difficult descent. Ada had warned him in a recent letter that she had changed considerably, in contour as well as in color. She wore a corset which stressed the unfamiliar stateliness of her body, enveloped in a black velvet gown of a flowing cut both eccentric and monastic, as their mother used to favor. She had had her hair bobbed pageboy fashion and dyed a brilliant bronze. Her neck and hands were as delicately pale as ever, but showed unfamiliar fibers and raised veins. She made lavish use of cosmetics to camouflage the lines at the outer corners of her fat carmined lips and dark-shadowed eyes, whose opaque iris now seemed less mysterious than myopic, owing to the nervous flutter of her painted lashes. He noted that her smile revealed the gold-capped upper premolar. He had a similar one on the other side of his mouth. The metallic sheen of her fringe distressed him less than that velvet gown, full-skirted, square-shouldered, of well below the calf length, with hip padding which was supposed both to diminish the waist and disguise by amplification the outline of the now buxom pelvis. Nothing remained of her gangling grace, and the new mellowness and the velvet stuff had an irritatingly dignified air of obstacle and defense. He loved her much too tenderly, much too irrevocably, to be unduly depressed by sexual misgivings, but his senses certainly remained stirless. So stirless, in fact, that he did not feel at all anxious as she and he raised their flashing champagne glasses in parody of the crested grebe ritual to involve his masculine pride in a half-hearted embrace immediately after dinner. If he was expected to do so, that was too bad. If he was not, that was even worse. At their earlier reunions, the constraint, subsisting as a dull ache after the keen agonies of fate's surgery, used to be soon drowned in sexual desire, leaving life to pick up by and by. Now, they were on their own. The utilitarian trivialities of their table talk, or rather, of his gloomy monologue, seemed to him positively degrading. He explained at length, fighting her attentive silence, sloshing across the puddles of pauses, abhorring himself, that he had a long and hard journey, that he slept badly, that he was working on an investigation of the nature of time, a theme that meant struggling with the octopus of one's own brain. She looked at her wristwatch. "What I'm telling you," he said harshly, "has nothing to do with timepieces." The waiter brought them their coffee. She smiled, and he realized that her smile was prompted by a conversation at the next table, at which a newcomer, a stout, sad Englishman, had begun a discussion of the menu with the maître d'hôtel. "I'll start," said the Englishman, "with the bananas."
That's not bananas, sir. That's ananas, pineapple juice."
"Oh, I see. Well, give me some clear soup." Young Van smiled back at young Ada. Oddly, that little exchange at the next table acted as a kind of delicious release. "When I was a kid," said Van, "and stayed for the first, or rather second, time in Switzerland, I thought that Verglas on roadway signs stood for some magical town, always around the corner, at the bottom of every snowy slope, never seen, but biding its time. I got your cable in the Engadine, where there are real magical places such as Alraun or Alruna, which means a tiny Arabian demon in a German wizard's mirror. By the way, we have the old apartment upstairs with an additional bedroom, number 508.
"Oh, dear, I'm afraid you must cancel poor 508. If I stayed for the night, 510 would do for both of us. But I've got bad news for you. I can't stay. I must go back to Geneva directly after dinner to retrieve my things and maids, whom the authorities have apparently put in a home for stray females because they could not pay the absolutely medieval new droit de douane. Isn't Switzerland in Washington State, sort of, après tout? Look, don't scowl."
Patting his brown, blotched hand on which their shared birthmark had got lost among the freckles of age, like a babe in autumn woods, "on peut le suivre en reconnaissant." Only Masco da Gama's disfigured thumb and the beautiful almond-shaped nails.
"I promise to get in touch with you in a day or two, and then we'll go on a cruise to Greece with the Baynards. They have a yacht and three adorable daughters who still swim in the tan, okay?"
"I don't know what I loathe more," he replied, "yachts or Baynards. But can I help you in Geneva?" He could not. Baynard had married his Cordula after a sensational divorce. Scotch veterinaries had had to saw off her husband's antlers. Last call for that joke. Ada's Argus had not yet been delivered. The gloomy black gloss of the Hackney yak and the old-fashioned leggings of its driver reminded him of her departure in 1905. He saw her off and descended like a Cartesian glass man, like spectral time standing at attention back to his desolate fifth floor. Had they lived together these 17 wretched years, they would have been spared the shock and the humiliation. Their aging would have been a gradual adjustment as imperceptible as time itself. His work in progress, a sheaf of notes tangling with his pajamas, came to the rescue as it had done at Sorcière. Van swallowed a Favadorm tablet and while waiting for it to relieve him of himself, a matter of 40 minutes or so, sat down at a lady's bureau to his lucubrantiancula. Does the ravage and outrage of age, deplored by poets, tell the naturalist of time anything about time's essence? Very little. Only a novelist's fancy could be caught by this small oval box, once containing duvet de Ninon, a face powder with a bird of paradise on the lid, which has been forgotten in a not-quite-closed drawer of the bureau's Ark of Triumph. Not, however, triumph over time.
The blue-green-orange thing looked as if he were meant to be deceived into thinking it had been waiting there 17 years for the bemused, smiling finder's dream-slow hand, a shabby trick of feigned restitution, a planted coincidence, and a bad blunder, since it had been Lucette, now a mermaid in the groves of Atlantis, and not Ada, now a stranger somewhere near Morges in a black limousine, who had favored that powder. Throw it away, lest it mislead a weaker philosopher. What I am concerned with is the delicate texture of time, void of all embroidered events. Let us recapitulate. Physiologically, the sense of time is a sense of continuous becoming. And if becoming has a voice, the latter might be, not unnaturally, a steady vibration. But for log's sake, let us not confuse time with tinnitus, and the seashell hum of duration with the throb of our blood. Philosophically, on the other hand, time is but memory in the making. In every individual life, there goes on from cradle to deathbed the gradual shaping and strengthening of that backbone of consciousness, which is the time of the strong. To be means to know one has been. Not to be implies the only new kind of sham time. The future. I dismiss it. Life, love, libraries have no future. Time is anything but the popular triptych, a no longer existing past, the durationless point of the present, and a not yet that may never come. No, there are only two panels. The past, ever existing in my mind, and the present, to which my mind gives duration and therefore reality. If we make a third compartment of fulfilled expectation, the foreseen, the foreordained, the faculty of prevision, perfect forecast, we are still applying our mind to the present. If the past is perceived as a storage of time, and if the present is the process of that perception, the future, on the other hand, is not an item of time, has nothing to do with time, and with the dim gauze of its physical texture. The future is but a quack at the court of Kronos. Thinkers, social thinkers, feel the present as pointing beyond itself toward a not yet realized future, but that is topical utopia, progressive politics. Technological sophists argue that by taking advantage of the laws of light, by using new telescopes revealing ordinary print at cosmic distances through the eyes of our nostalgic agents on another planet, we can actually see our own past. Goodson, discovering the Goodson, and that sort of thing. Including documentary evidence of our not knowing what lay in store for us, and our knowing now, and that consequently the future did exist yesterday, and by inference does exist today. This may be good physics, but it is execrable logic, and the tortoise of the past will never overtake the Achilles of the future, no matter how we parse distances on our cloudy blackboards. What we do at best, at worst we perform trivial tricks when postulating the future, is to expand enormously the specious present, causing it to permeate any amount of time with all manner of information, anticipation, and precognition. At best, the future is the idea of a hypothetical present based on our experience of succession, on our faith in logic and habit. Actually, of course, our hopes can no more bring it into existence than our regrets change the past. The latter has at least the taste, the tinge, the tang of our individual being. But the future remains aloof from our fancies and feelings. At every moment, it is an infinity of branching possibilities. A determinate scheme would abolish the very notion of time. Here the pill floated its first cloudlet. The unknown, the not yet experienced and the unexpected, all the glorious X intersections are the inherent parts of human life. The determinate scheme, by stripping the sunrise of its surprise, would erase all sun rays. The pill had really started to work. He finished changing into his pajamas, a series of fumbles, mostly unfinished, which he had begun an hour ago, and fumbled into bed. He dreamed that he was speaking in the lecturing hall of a transatlantic liner and that a bum resembling the hitchhiker from Hilden was asking sneeringly, "How did the lecturer explain that in our dreams we know we shall awake? Is not that analogous to the certainty of death, and if so, the future?" At daybreak, he sat up with an abrupt moan and trembling. If he did not act now, he would lose her forever. He decided to drive at once to the Manhattan in Geneva. Van welcomed the renewal of polished structures after a week of black fudge fouling the bowl slope so high that no amount of flushing could dislodge it. Something to do with olive oil and the Italian-type water closets. He shaved, bathed, rapidly dressed. Was it too early to order breakfast? Should he ring up her hotel before starting? Should he rent a plane? Or might it perhaps be simpler? The doorfolds of his drawing-room balcony stood wide open. Banks of mist still crossed the blue of the mountains beyond the lake, but here and there a peak was tipped with ochre under the cloudless turquoise of the sky. Four tremendous trucks thundered by one after another. He went up to the rail of the balcony and wondered if he had ever satisfied the familiar whim by going platch. Had he? Had he? You could never know, really. One floor below, and somewhat adjacently, stood Ada, engrossed in the view. He saw her bronze bob, her white neck and arms, the pale flowers on her flimsy peignoir, her bare legs, her high-heeled silver slippers. Pensively, youngly, voluptuously, she was scratching her thigh at the rise of the right buttock. Lador's pink signature on vellum at mosquito dusk. Would she look up? All her flowers turned up to him, beaming, and she made the royal grant gesture of lifting and offering him the mountains, the mist, and the lake with three swans. He left the balcony and ran down a short spiral staircase to the fourth floor. In the pit of his stomach there sat the suspicion that it might not be room 410, as he conjectured, but 412 or even 414. What would happen if she had not understood, was not on the lookout? She had. She was. When, a little later, Van, kneeling and clearing his throat, was kissing her dear, cold hands, gratefully, gratefully, in full defiance of death, with bad fate routed and her dreamy afterglow bending over him, she asked, "Did you really think I had gone?"
"Obmanshitsa, deceiver. Obmanshitsa," Van kept repeating with the fervor and gloat of blissful satiety.
"I told him to turn," she said, "somewhere near Morge."
"Morses or walruses, a Russian pun on morge. Maybe a mermaid's message."
"And you slept. You could sleep."
"I worked," he replied. "My first draft is done."
She confessed that on coming back in the middle of the night, she had taken to her room from the hotel bookcase. The night porter, an avid reader, had the key. The British Encyclopedia volume. Here it was, with this article on space-time. "Space," it says here rather suggestively, "denotes the property, you are my property, in virtue of which you are my virtue. Rigid bodies can occupy different positions." "Nice? Nice?"
"Don't laugh, my Ada, at our philosophic prose," remonstrated her lover. "All that matters just now is that I have given new life to time by cutting off Siamese space and the false future. My aim was to compose a kind of novella in the form of a treatise on the texture of time, an investigation of its veily substance, with illustrative metaphors gradually increasing, very gradually building up a logical love story, going from past to present, blossoming as a concrete story, and just as gradually reversing analogies and disintegrating again into bland abstraction."
"I wonder," said Ada, "I wonder if the attempt to discover those things is worth the stained glass. We can know the time. We can know a time. We can never know time. Our senses are simply not meant to perceive it. It is like..."